Welcome to Next Talk, powered by Compass Group. We're discussing how today's climate will impact the future of on-site food service. Bringing together the most innovative thought leaders, this series will explore how we adapt to the new normal, contribute to a successful outcome, and help lead the industry for the long term. Joining us today on Next Talk is Dan Barber, who is extraordinary both in and outside the kitchen. Dan is the chef and co-owner of New York's Blue Hill Restaurants, co-creator of Rose 7 Seed Company, and author of The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. Also joining us is Amy Keister, Compass Group's Senior Vice President of Sustainability and Culinary, who will take the conversation from here. Amy?
Thanks, Laura. Dan, it's such an honor to have you on our podcast. You have been an inspiration to so many of us as a top food mind in the country, as well as a pioneer in food. Our COO, Rick Close, he's constantly asking us to challenge the status quo, and that's exactly what you've done in your career. You've embraced the complexity of nature, you're obsessed with flavor, and delivering exceptionally delicious foods that's good for people and planet. All of this aligns nicely with the food philosophy at Compass, so we're just so great to be here. Let's start with the current climate first. I think everybody is aware on how restaurants and chefs are being affected, but it's just as devastating to farmers, specifically small farms. You've really used your voice over the past month to be an advocate for them, and you've done a great job with your resource, which is taking delicious ingredients that you would have been serving in your restaurant into take-home meals. So we're curious to know, like, what immediate changes do you see in the current environment, specifically with farming? And then what can we be doing, specifically as chefs and those in food service?
And as you know, 6 weeks ago, that's what most people were talking about, was climate change and environmental dysfunction, and how food and the way we produce food was a big driver in that. Well, now we have a moment where the COVID-19 has shuttered the very people who kickstarted the farm to table movement. It was really started by chefs, and the ones who have over the years expanded it, made it more accessible, more impregnated into the food called the American food culture. And these farms that supply chefs with these ingredients are particularly vulnerable because the market for the restaurants has closed, and because they just don't have the cash flow and they don't have the ability to pivot in a way that would allow them to get through the next 6 months. Right now, it's still new, and you know, farmers can adapt quickly to some retail sales. But retail sales for these kind of farmers is not the answer, because the seeds they have are not really of interest. The kind of diversity that they work with, for the most part, is expensive, and labor is expensive. Part of this resource program, we launched an investigative unit, so it's like five people who all day are spending their time actually backing up what I just said in a scientific way, like asking a real detailed survey to these farmers and getting an understanding of what are we facing in the coming months. I want to make sure that this survey backs up what I'm saying, and so far it has, unfortunately. And I want to get it out to the public. That's part of what we're doing is researching. I mean, resource is partly source, but it's also research. And how do we catalog what's happening in real time? And then the last part of resource, the education part, is how do we resource ed is what it is, ED. You know, the education part is what can we do about this? So could we create more of a consciousness about what's going on through the data? That's for sure. And then we have to kick into, you know, the education about what's possible. What can we do? How can our buying habits change? How can we advocate for government intervention? How can we advocate for loans? How can we push and pull markets, the supermarkets and grocery stores, into the local food economy in a way that they aren't today? There's a part of me that also feels a sense of excitement about this moment because it is so drastic, and we as human beings, I guess, Americans especially, tend not to move on things until they become emergencies. And I would suggest that we are in such a time right now.
I know all the farmers are so grateful that you're collecting this data and bringing light to this issue. You mentioned the excitement. So Where's the excitement? Is there a silver lining? What? How do we rebuild this? Where do you see this going, and how can we help as Compass and as individual consumers?
Compass plays a role here that a chef like me can't play. In order to be responsive to the kind of farming that we want for the future, it turns out we need in the farm to table movement a few more middlemen. I mean, that's in fact, if we had been talking 8 weeks ago, you'd forgive me for saying that actually farm to table movement is the most resilient and the most sustainable food chain imaginable, because it's the farmer who grows your food, shakes your hand, and you put it on your table. And in a COVID moment, you can't shake the hand of the farmer. You can't even get access to the farmer if you're a restaurant. And all of a sudden, COVID exposes the Achilles heel and actually the weakness, the grand weakness of our food chain, in the way that it's exposed the weaknesses of the big food chain. And that's, I think, the answer to both on a large level and on a regional small scale level, is that we just don't have the right infrastructure in place physically and culturally. Physically is we just don't have enough slaughterhouses to do the work that I described, enough butchers to do the work I described, enough fermenters to do the work I described per region. We tend to centralize that through big agribusiness and big food. And the second part that we don't have is the cultural. And that's why we have a centralized processing mentality. Because when you think of processed food, what if we thought of food processing as both being a lifeline to farmers, always a lifeline to farmers, because of the amount of tonnage that you can take, you can soak up what truly is a harvest that are hard to predict. And you can then take that tonnage and you can make it more delicious, more nutritious by making it bioavailable. The ferment is going on in front of me. Is increasing nutrition for our bodies. It's increasing flavor too. And you get this knock-on effect where the farmer gets bought into the system. You know, the future with Compass and your stakeholder status and the strength of your company is to invest more in the kind of processing that will engage Americans and food service establishments in ways that start to shift the culture, because that's what we need. We need a cultural shift.
That's beautifully said. And we're energized just thinking about it, and exactly why we wanted you on here today to talk to us. Let's pivot slightly, just because when we talk about cultural change, and you know, I can't think of anyone who's a chef that's brought more to the notion and the cultural shift to food waste than you, especially with your pop-up Wasted. We were supposed to be having this conversation in person on our International Day of Action Stop Food Waste Day, as you really have been an inspiration to chefs and to kind of the food community when it comes to food waste. Why does it matter? I think maybe now, so it might even resonate even more. And where do you kind of see it going? And how does that play in when we look to this new normal?
To answer the first question, you know, why does it matter? I think it's quite simple that we have statistics that tell us that 30, 40, even more percent of food that is harvest or just pre-harvest is lost to food waste. And when you think of more than a third of the caloric possibilities in the world go to waste, it's stunning. And the reason, of course, it's depressing and it's totally disheartening for people who are food insecure and go hungry. But that's more the obvious. What's so disheartening is that it gives big agriculture the ammunition to say, we've got to feed the world. We've got to up the amount of yields we get per acre. Because if you don't, look what happens. We don't have enough to feed people. That's our food culture. This is not a signature of the moment, a modern moment thing where we're just wasteful people. The Americans have been wasteful about food since the day we came on to Plymouth Rock. We were very rich from soil health perspective to our temperate climate to from the get-go. We were an agricultural powerhouse even before we started really cultivating the earth. Americans. We were the breadbasket world right away. We stopped talking about food waste in the context of ugly fruits and vegetables and you know, the piece of meat that we don't finish on our plate and the bread that we toss away. And though those are all the images we have in our mind when we talk about food waste, I think it's the wrong frame because it's too simple. It's too easy. It lets you feel good about, you know, wrapping up that piece of bread and using it as toast the next morning and say, hey, I cut down on food waste. Well, you know, you also had, you know, for dinner that night before, you had a steak, you know, and when you had your steak, which was corn and soy fed, you were utilizing part of 160 million acres of corn and soybeans. 160 million acres of corn and soybeans that does not a lick of it goes to feed people directly. It goes to feed animals mostly. It goes to feed our gas tanks a little bit, less now during this moment, and other plastics and other things. So corn syrups and others, but it doesn't feed us. And so the most wasteful thing that we can do in the world and in the history of the world is to eat a steak at this point, to eat a conventional steak. And my point is I'm love steak, so I don't want to, and I'm not sitting here as a vegetarian, but I love a grass-fed steak. I like a steak that opts out of that food chain and instead just takes the energy from the sun that feeds the grass, and grass feeds the cows, and cows feed us. That's truly sustainable. It's also actually much more delicious. But when we talk about food waste, I would say Compa should take the lead on getting away from framing the conversation with easy lifts, because your company is too smart, you have too many good people working for it, and your brand is too strong to like go to the most obvious denominator. My perspective on this is that you all should take the lead on changing the conversation. Get away from the easy stuff. Start digging into what does a buffet line look like for you guys in the future? What is, you know, food service look like? What is a plate of food? Let's start at a plate of food. Because if we can change the diner's expectations for protein-centric plates of food and shift that to you know, what we're serving in one of these boxes is a carrot steak. These huge carrots that were in storage for us, and we hung them for 2 weeks coated in beef fat, and we're roasting them right now, about to roast them right now, and we're going to serve them as steaks with all the fixings in this box for people to pick up, you know, cream spinach and little bone marrow and an herb butter, and, you know, we're going to have potatoes and that side, but it's going to be a carrot steak because that's what our ecology, our environment produces really well right now, and we ought to think about a plate of food centered with grains and vegetables and use meat, eat meat, for sure eat meat. You need to eat meat in this environment, meaning our ecological environment of the Hudson Valley where I'm standing. You know, meat is essential, but do it in proportion to the way the carrying capacity of the earth works. And that's not to have 6 ounces of meat on your plate twice a day, 7 days a week. That's the westernized conception of a plate of food. It's an American expectation for a plate of food, and we ought to get away from it.
Dan, we're loving what you're saying. With Compass, we've been part of Menus of Change for the past 5 years, where we've really been looking to challenge the plate. And then just, you know, a few months ago, we were looking at 2030. What does that mean? What do we want to stand for? And it's something you've written a lot about, and you were briefly talking about, but it's that whole idea of regenerative agriculture, because to us, we think that's the hope, and that's really what we want to make the basis of kind of what our food philosophy for sustainability, culinary, and wellness is. You mentioned your book. I'll plug it, The Third Plate. It is, especially now when we're quarantined, an absolute fascinating read. And even though you mentioned it was 10 years ago, I think it's more relevant now than ever. We talk about soil, but there's not many people that want to talk soil. However, I think it's very important. What does it mean to you? Like, what does regenerative ag mean to you, this whole idea of soil health, and how should we be thinking about that going forward?
Soil is where flavor resides, because where mineralities are, where minerals are. And minerals are what our bodies crave. And so it's actually health, flavor, deliciousness. It's one subject, and it starts and pretty much ends in soil. I mean, it's like it's not. Yeah, there's a lot of other factors. There's the seed. Of course, I started a seed company that's invested in the genetics of that whole conversation. That's critically important. and the farmers, you know, attuning to when a product is picked and everything is important. But the soil is the real moment of a possibility for flavor. And then when I think of regenerative agriculture, of course, I think of soil because I just said it's the keystone part of this conversation. But I would just shift, you know, since we're talking to a company that cooks a lot of food, you know, I would shift that regenerative to a regenerative food culture, because regenerative agriculture is really dependent on the food culture dictating what the agriculture is. It's not the other way around. Agriculture doesn't dictate food culture. We dictate the food culture. We dictate the food culture, which then dictates the agriculture. So regenerative should really be thought of as like, what is it? What could we be doing on our menus? What could we be offering that regenerate soil health? And I'll give you an example. We love good wheat. We love wheat that produces, you know, delicious bread. Then we ought to support barley, because we know that barley rotated into wheat. Barley planted, harvested, and then planted on wheat will give you an exceptional wheat crop. Exceptional. We know that. That's actually, we know that in part because, look, you know, in Europe, thousands of years ago, that was the connection to beer and bread. I mean, bread was, you know, part of the coming out of the Fertile Crescent with Einkorn wheat, but beer was right there with it because you couldn't have wheat without barley. So barley was the malt which made the beer, and wheat was the flour that made the bread. So that kind of corresponds. Look, it's the same thing in Japan. You have rice, but to get a rice crop, you need buckwheat. So you had to have buckwheat to break up disease cycles and give fertility for rice. But what did the Japanese do? They didn't have me waving the finger saying you better eat your buckwheat. They created soba noodles. And so to eat, another way of looking at Japanese cooking cuisine is to say, if you want to eat your bowl of rice twice a day, you have to eat your soba. Not a bad price to pay. Another way to say this, if you want to have your bread, you got to drink your beer. Also not a bad price to pay. If you want to, you know, if you're in the South, in the global South, you want to have your corn, your maize, you got to have your beans, because the legumes are the ones that gave you the nitrogen, that gave you a big stock of corn. So they figured that out. So that becomes part of the cuisine and the culture. And that's the negotiation that's so important. You know, I think the opportunity for regenerative is to not put the onus on the farming community for regenerative ag, to put the onus on the eating community. It's regenerative food culture. And then the onus is on Compass. It's the onus on you. The vector points at you. How can you say to yourselves, we are not going to serve, we're going to do the wheat, barley example on the rice and buckwheat example. We're going to do that with our regions and our farmers. And we are not going to put something on the menu that concentrates on wheat unless that farmer's growing. We're talking about moving markets with you guys. So that would, to me, that's the most sustainable way to think about farming. It's to you put the onus on yourselves and your chefs to figure out how to make millet delicious, because that's what your farmer needs to grow for soil health and needs to grow to be organic or whatever the issue is. You want to celebrate that wheat crop, make sure you pay for it through the other crops. But that's on us, on chefs, to figure out how to bring that into the culture in a way that's pleasurable and delightful, in the same way the Japanese brought soba noodles into the culture. So that's my challenge for your company and your chefs.
Challenge accepted. It's so beautiful. And I love the switch of taking the culture piece, because you're right. It's not for the farmers. It is for us. It is for the chefs and for the food community to really make that cultural shift. However, you are going to be able to help us greatly. You plugged your Grow 7 briefly. I had the pleasure of sitting down and sampling twice now, and I'm still dreaming of those potatoes. And you mentioned barley. I never knew barley could be so delicious. So yeah. Talk to us a bit about Grow 7. I know actually all my siblings have the seeds. We're all kind of in competition on who can build the most elaborate contraptions for them, and we can't wait to start, you know, harvesting them over the summer. But what was the impetus behind the seed company, behind the barley, and then how can we take more advantage of your barley so that we can do exactly what you're saying with this regenerative food culture?
in many ways why I started Rose 7, a seed company, was because you can't circle out, you can't do the things that I was talking about doing, support the right kind of agricultural system as in a regenerative food culture, if you don't have the seeds to make that happen. And in the case of barley, which I think is what you're getting at, you know, we were working with a breeder in the Pacific Northwest who was doing culinary barley. Well, nobody does culinary barley. This particular breeder who, you know, we really champion at Rose 7, the seed company, is taking old varieties but updating them, making them more productive, actually more delicious, and bringing in the culinary characteristics to barley. And, you know, the flavor is jaw-dropping. I mean, it's just unbelievably delicious. You need nothing else. It's boiled in water with a little bit of salt. It's an extraordinary experience. And the yield on it's very good, and it's meant for organic farmers, so the disease resistance is very good. And it's a farmer that will grow it now and get a good yield, and now what we need is the market for it. And I think that'll come because the flavor is so delicious. That's why I started the company. My bet is that a lot of these varieties that we need to be growing for farmers, for the health of the soil, as we got back to it, the health of the soil, we need to be growing them. We need to give people the seeds that actually taste good. And we need to give farmers seeds that actually yield good. And without those two things, this whole, you know, call to action is going to last about as long as this conversation. It's like, who cares? It doesn't taste good. What's the point? And if the farmer can't make money doing it, what's the point? That was the idea behind the company, and we've launched out with a bunch of seeds that are really extraordinary, and it's the work of breeders who were given the light of day, which is the main thing. It's like breeders don't talk to chefs. That's the concept behind the company. They talk to the industry. And the industry, what the hell does the industry know about anything? They want less diversity, consistency, and they want yield. And those three factors, you know, give you the barley that is pig food.
Dan, we love your bold ideas. We love your excitement, your passion, how you want us to seize the moment. I think you've given us a lot to think about. Specifically, I love this whole regenerative food culture and how we can really take the lead and create a great momentum. Any ending parting thoughts for Compass on just what do we need to be thinking about when we rebuild and how we can just be stronger than ever and really doing what's right for people and planet?
Look, I like your company a lot, and I respect it a lot. I respect its size, and you know, I'm usually associated with you know, small bespoke you know, individual efforts, which are always very important. But there aren't a lot of companies like yours that are driven with, like I said, really good people and really driven by really good people and execution at a very, very high altitude. And that's just very hard to do. So that's why I respect it. My feeling is that I would go very bold coming out of COVID. I would use this moment as a reset. And this has to come top down. You know, where I'm a bottom up guy, but in the company now I'm talking to the top brass here, because this is the kind of culture you have to feed. And when I say, you know, reset, I mean really push the envelope at this moment on what's possible with food and agriculture. And, you know, in a moment when the bottom line is hurting for you all and for everyone, mm-hmm. It's a very, very tough thing to demand or to ask or to suggest. But it is ultimately an investment in the future, because you guys could define what is so obvious that needs to happen. I do not have my pulse on something that is, you know, an outlier ideas or ideas that you know are rooted in you know, in fallacy or whatever, or in you know, dreaming up wild ideas. This is where the future of food is going. It may take a while to get there, but your company will be there in the future, and you ought to stake a claim, very, very well defined claim. Now, in this moment, because there's nothing like an emergency like this to help redefine your interests and the things that most drive you. And if you want to retain the quality people that you have in your company from the top down, I can tell you from being very now involved with the younger generation of cooks and food service people, I mean, they are well informed. They are well informed. And this is a generation that that wants to do right by how the planet is treated, how farmers are treated, what the nutrition in food is, and they won't let you off. You will not have the kind of quality people that you want to have in your company for the future if you don't make the changes. So in that sense, it's forced on you, and it's hard to see that. You know, it's hard to see it, but I clearly see companies that have embraced that and they're thriving. And I've seen companies that have not embraced the culture of the moment, which is these young people are passionate about where food comes from, how it's grown, and want to be a part of a workplace environment that isn't window dressing, that is from root and branch dealing with these issues aggressively. And now's the moment to reset that, because you'll never have a time like this, or I hope we never have a time like this in our lifetime. It's so stark. So that's my wish to you, and you know, I hope a lot of good luck here as you move on.
This is our moment, and this has been so inspiring. I cannot thank you enough for taking the time. You truly are an inspiration and a role model to us all in the food space, and look forward to having many more of these discussions and discussing actions and strategy with you in the future. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much for the great question. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you both for such a thought-provoking conversation about the future of the food culture. Dan, what are you most excited about doing once social distancing is over?
Oh, my God, hugging my friends. Hugging my cooks. How about that?
Cooks. I love it. What's something you started doing during the stay at home that you want to keep going?
Oh, seeing my kids. It's been the most wonderful feeling I've been very busy and been on Zoom calls. And then when I'm in the kitchen, I'm crazy like today, but I make it home for dinner. I mean, that's a first for me. And my kids are young, I have a 7-year-old, and I've rarely been home for dinner. It's just like, it is so great, really great. That part of this has been the sweetest moment of my life, really.
Oh, that's nice. And if you had a top choice for personal time right now, is that doing a puzzle, listening to a podcast, playing a board game, watching a movie, or reading a book?
I'm reading a book. I mean, read. I just don't. I'm not reading at all, and I'm hurting. I'd love to get into a good book and not be bothered with other things for an hour or two. It'd be wonderful. I'll get there.
Well, you'll get there. Thank you, Amy. Dan, thank you so much, both of you, for your time. And we really, truly look forward to navigating what's next together. We want to keep this conversation going. Join us at compassgroup.podbean.com to listen to a new episode every week. If you have questions or a request, send them to envisiongroup@compass-usa.com. Until then, be safe and be well.